Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the second of this year's series in our Hellenic Observatory Research Seminars. And it gives me very great pleasure to welcome this evening Dr. Panayota Manoli, an old friend and colleague who has been a visiting fellow in the Hellenic Observatory over the last year, various periods. She has got an undergraduate degree from the University of Athens, from the School of Law, Economic and Political Sciences, and she did her postgraduate studies both at the MA and PhD level at the University of Warwick, where she was an Alexander Onassis Foundation scholar. Currently, Panayota is an assistant professor in political economy of international relations at the Department of Mediterranean Studies at the University of the Aegean, and she also works, she heads a department at ELIAMEP, which is the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, where she deals with Slavic, East European, and Eurasian studies. She's also had a long-time involvement with the Black Sea in an institutional capacity, and she works on various aspects of comparative regionalism, security and development, the European neighborhood, and Black Sea politics. This evening, she is here with us to talk about a fascinating aspect of Greek foreign policy, which has been in the news not only in the last few months, but also in the last few years. Basically, she is talking to the question, the topic of reframing Greece's Russian policy. Panayota is going to speak for about 40 minutes or so, and then have plenty of time for discussion. Let me just remind you that we are being recorded, so behave yourselves. And also, for those of you who are technologically up to date, we have got a Twitter hashtag, which is at LSE Greece, if you wish to tweet during the process of this evening's seminar. I won't be doing it, but if you wish to do it, you can. Panayota, over to you.
Thank you, Spiros, for the introduction. And let me also thank the Hellenic Observatory and Spiros as well for actually giving me the chance to work a little bit here on the issue of Greek-Russian relations. And I hope that this seminar will also, you know, be a good opportunity for me to hear about my work and your views on this topic. Starting from what Spiros said, actually the first time I got a first-hand experience on how Greek-Russian relations evolve was during my work at the Black Sea Economic Cooperation Organization, which is based in Istanbul. At that time I had the chance to actually see how the two sides, Greeks and Russians, and the diplomats as well as the staff of the organization would be able to run the politics of every day in an organization, but also draft together, agree and disagree on specific statements, resolutions, agreements, and so on. And that was a very interesting experience because the whole interaction was taking place in the framework of an organization. So there was a multilateral framework within which this bilateral interaction was taking place. Now let me come back to today's topic, which is actually reframing Greece's Russian policy. Now, normally Greek-Russian relations wouldn't actually make great headlines. Still, however, nevertheless, today we see that there is a very there is a lot of interest on behalf of the academics as well as the policymakers. I would say that the reason for this interest is linked to the interest that the international community has for each of the two parties separately. For Greece, due to the economic crisis that has been actually going through for over nearly a decade now, so it has been seen as a, let's say, troublemaker in terms of the economic governance in Europe, but also worldwide, we can say. And also because of the political repercussions that this crisis brought to the Greek political system and the emergence for the first time of an anti-establishment government in Greece through the Syriza-Nel coalition. Now, Russia also has been regarded as a troublemaker in the last decade and as a state that actually poses one of the greatest threats in terms of the European security order. For these reasons, therefore, the international community has looked upon both cases, Greece and Russia. Greece has been any links between the two countries, between the two states, have been actually interpreted as a covert threat to the European stability. And Greece has been lately described as a Trojan horse, a term that we are all familiar with, as a solid ally of Russia, constituting a category of its own in the, among the other EU members, maybe along with Cyprus. The Prague Manual, published in 2018 by the European Values Think Tank in Prague, identifies Greece and Cyprus as a collaborator of Russia, as countries where the government is denying the existence of a disinformation threat or even welcomes and assists Russian efforts to spread its influence. There are other analysts, however, that they dismiss this kind of Trojan horse approach. And one of them, Karagiannis, he's not among with us here, he argues that this actually is a manifestation of neo-Orientalism, as he calls it, and he argues that actually the main reason behind all this attention is that Greece has been constantly suspecting as a Trojan horse for Russian interest, very much like the Serbia and other Orthodox majority countries in Eastern Europe. It is a new form of neo-Orientalism that goes against the convention logic of international relations. Now, the paper focuses in the post-2000 era, and it's an era where, on the Russian side, we see a continuation of policy, and power has been actually held by Vladimir Putin since actually spring 2000, that actually took over the presidency in Russia. On the other hand, on the Greek side, there has been no continuity. We've seen actually since then 8 prime ministers taking power, not all of them elected, and this actually has increased the unpredictability in foreign policy of Greece. And it's not just that we have seen different, you know, in terms of the number, the large number of prime ministers, but we've seen power parties from all the political spectrum for the first time in Greece taking power, from the right wing to the left wing and central also parties, anti-establishment parties and establishment, pro-establishment parties. Now, the paper attempts actually to discuss Greece's Russian policy as a special relationship, which is, however, developing in an EU context. So we do try to understand what that special relationship is and whether it has actually content and how this content is affected by EU. Any discussion, actually, and we also have to clarify here that this paper has a, let's say, Athenian-centered, so it looks into how Athens identifies this relationship, its interests, and perceives and shapes its policy towards Russia rather than vice versa. Now, any discussion on Greek-Russian relations starts with the notion of a special relationship. This has been described in the past by the phrase Hellas Russia Symmachia, Hellas Russia Alliance, pointing actually to deeply rooted historical, cultural, and identity links. But these links unite actually the people to start with and the societies, but they could also lead to some sort of interstate close cooperation and probably a geopolitical access. Russia is actually the only big power with which this term of special relationship has been appearing and has been accepted throughout the political spectrum in Greece. And it has been coined regularly by the Greek political elite. The changes in the international relations in the post-Cold War era allowed for this special relationship to be often evoked by the political elite in Athens, and the centrality of Russia to global affairs has actually always presented Athens with new policy dilemmas that it had to deliberate on. Now, how can one, how can we actually understand this special relationship in IR context? Now, special relationships are not protectorates, and they do not imply military alliances or security communities. They are durable, exclusive, bilateral relationships between autonomous polities that they are based on mutual expectations of preferential treatment by its members and outsiders, as well as a regular entanglement of some sort of external governance factions. Now, special relationships are exactly relations of solidarity in which members actually are bound by a special relatedness and commitment to each other. This solidarity is based on historical experience. It could be not necessarily common history, but also guilt or a reconciliation process could build a special relationship. It builds on current needs. And promises of reciprocal effort. It implies perceived needs that only the special partner can fulfill. Now, there is no an ideal type of special relationship, and for some analysts, it's better if we understand these relationships as instances of interstate interaction that displays some type of repetition. There is no, as we said, the type of single type of an ideal type of relationship, and the discussion on special relationships is rather atheoretical and it's history driven. There are. We can say three ways to actually explain how these special relationships emerge and evolve. From a realist point of view, we would focus on power asymmetries and security interests. Liberals point to policy interdependencies and give an emphasis on elite as well preferences. And there is a third path. A constructivist path that actually would point to positive or negative identification with the other. And here perceptions and identities would be actually the driving force and would actually give the content and the substance of any special relationship. For all these, despite the differences in these three paths of reading special relationships, still all of them indicate a rational action. Therefore, this is a common basis. Now, let's focus. I will just say a last point, and then we will go back to specifically how this relationship takes shape in the Greek-Russian case. The interesting thing about special relationships is that they have also played a crucial role in promoting or impeding formal international institutions. The case of France and Germany, for example, is can be considered under these lenses. Or even the Anglo-American one, not generally today, but also with regard to the Bretton Woods, for example, regime that was established. Let's now focus specifically on the particular features of Greek-Russian relationship. Is Greek-Russian relationship a special one? What about its durability? The durability of Greek-Russian relationship, special relationship, has not been tested. Policy-wise, and as a policy practice, is a relatively new one. Though there have been historical links between the two parties, that they go even back to the 19th century, it was actually around 2004 when the new government of Kostas Karamanlis took power, and they actually were the first one who tried to policy-wise, implement this type of special relationship and give it a policy content. This is very interesting because the party that actually promoted this relationship, the Conservative Party of New Democracy, was the one that actually was the main pro-EU party in Greece and the one that actually anchored the country into the European Union already back in the 60s. And it's also interesting in terms of the names. It was Konstantinos Karamalis at that time and Kostas Karamalis later on for the special relationship with Russia. Kostas Karamalis frequently referred to the friendship, the brotherhood, but also the strategic considerations behind this relationship. Putin as well called Greece in December 2004 as the closest partner and partner of Russia in Europe. And the Greek Prime Minister noted that you have called my country as a strategic partner. For Russia, Russia used more the term strategic partner rather than a special relationship. There is a difference as well. You have called my country as a strategic partner for Russia, and this corresponds to the level of our relationships, and I consider it a stable parameter for our foreign policy. Since then, we have to say that there has been no substantial any other change in terms of how this special relationship can actually move ahead. And for some observers of Greek foreign policy, 2018 maybe has actually brought an end to this special relationship for the reasons that we will see later on in this presentation. A second feature of this, let's discuss a second feature, it's the exclusiveness. Is this relationship, does this relationship indicate a certain level of exclusivity? Well, whenever this policy was conceived, even under Karamanlis' government, it would take place within. It was not conceived as an exclusive relationship, but on the contrary, it was an aspect of a new multilateral and multidimensional policy. That was considered to be necessary in this post-Cold War era. And actually, it was an expression and a specific dimension of EU's own strategic partnership with Moscow. It was the time that the strategic partnership with Moscow was still valid. It would fall within a framework of developing EU-Russian common spaces, that were agreed back in May 2003, and it would also fall along with the reset of relations between the US and Russia that happened in 2009. So there was no exclusivity, and that was also evident whenever the political elite of Greece would actually have a bilateral meeting with their Russian counterparts where the EU and EU policies were always a reference point and it was always there. Even in the period after 2015 and the emergence of this anti-establishment governance that emerged in Greece, the pro-Russian, let's say, policies that evolved were considered to be part of a new democratic and multi-vector foreign policy where Greece would have to expand its relation with other BRICS countries, India, China, etc. So there is no actually exclusiveness in terms of the bilateral relationship. Are there, however, perceived needs that only and interests that only the special partner can fulfill? Is there a preferential treatment between the two parties? most analysis rightly argue that Greek-Russian relations are not actually desecuritized, despite the fact that Russia has never been conceived, perceived as a security threat for Athens. Now, the driver behind Athens' interest in presenting itself as a privileged discussant of Moscow is existential security concerns. For Greece, along with Cyprus, we have to say, Greece, along with Cyprus, is the only actually EU NATO country among its partners that faces an existential threat from another NATO member, which is also an EU candidate country. Russia's position as a counterbalance against Turkey is relevant in Greek military strategy and foreign policy, and therefore there is a perception that Russia can actually fulfill a need for in security terms. Nevertheless, Moscow is not considered the primary security provider for Athens. There is a clear choice on behalf of Greece that the primary security provider has been NATO and the EU. Despite, therefore, recognizing Moscow's influence in Southeast Europe, where Greece faces its security problems, Athens' security agenda has been steadily Europeanized, and all its existential security concerns have been placed within an EU framework, whether this is Cyprus, with the accession, of course, of Cyprus in the EU, or the bilateral disputes with Turkey, with the pre-accession process and on, or with the dispute over the name of Fyrom. And we've seen the recent developments on that. Nevertheless, Russia has been important as a security provider because of its permanent seat at the UN Security Council with regard to the Cyprus issue, specifically the role it has to play, it can play. Should we say, therefore, that should we therefore dismiss any special role of Cyprus of Russia in the security considerations of Greece? As I said before, no, because there have been several instances of this special relation coming up repeatedly, and this has to do specifically with the veto power that Russia has in the UN Security Council. We've seen this veto in several occasions back in the 90s, where I think that Russia for the first time exercised its veto in the post-Cold War era, and that had to do with UN force in Cyprus. Nevertheless, Russia is not exactly directly involved in the negotiations taking place in terms of either the bilateral relations with Turkey or with Cyprus. Now, let's go back to another feature. Let's see another feature. And we can even say that if one gets another definition of what an existential threat is and looks into the economic aspects of security, there also one can see how that, again, Russia does not have this, is not able to fulfill any of the special economic, let's say, security needs of Greece, and we've seen this also in the summer of 2015, when there was no agreement between Greece and Russia over a loan that Greece would actually like to have from Russia and to avoid and skip a third bailout agreement with its lenders. Now, do we see any entanglement of external governance functions here also the opportunities and the chances for regular entanglement of some sort of external governance have been very limited between the two sides. There are only some occasions of regional institutions, such as the BISEC, the one I've mentioned before, where we can see some opportunities for this kind of common governance functions. Nevertheless, increasingly, any Greek external governance policy goes through the EU policies in the neighborhood, either this is the Eastern Partnership or the Euro-Mediterranean policies. Therefore, there is not such an entanglement in terms of the global issues, either in Middle East or anywhere else. The above discussion could indicate that there is nothing in terms of this special relationship, in terms of the content and the policy significance of this special relationship. However, we can say that this notion is not an entirely empty phrase, which is used out of politeness or the eagerness of Greeks to claim some closeness to a global power. Most academic commentary usually downplays the importance of the ties of sentiment, identity, and culture. But nevertheless, the two parties clearly do have historical and religious connections. For Greece, given its weakness vis-à-vis Russia in absolute terms, the use of culture and religion as a powerful tool has been used in elevating its importance in the minds of the Russian people. The Russian side uses this culture and identity element. For example, Sergei Lavrov has referred to this relationship, saying that there are few other countries that are so closely related as Russia and Greece, with such a long history of sincere friendship. The presence of Vladimir Putin twice in Athos fosters this type of perceptions. We have to say that, if I'm not mistaken, there has been only one official visit in Athens, two in Athos, and the fourth one was in a multilateral context with Bulgarians and Greeks for the signing of the Burgas Alexandropolis. And this is very interesting to see, where Putin prefers going when he comes to Greece. Now, what has been happening is that the Greek political elite has been using a positive narrative pointing exactly to the historical role of Russia. And these narratives are very important in actually giving some content to this specialness of Greece and Russian affairs. There are three specific narratives that have been used, and all of them stress the issue of solidarity, which is a key, I think, notion that has been playing a very important a role in shaping Greek policy towards its partners, either with Russia or even within an EU context, this solidarity notion. The first narrative goes back to history and the Greek independence war against the Ottoman Empire. Here the religion is stressed. And there is a popular myth that portrays the Tsar as the protector of the Orthodox people in the Balkans throughout the period of the Ottoman rule. The second narrative presents the Soviet Union as a fair arbiter, and nowadays Russia, of the Cyprus problem. And here we have an emphasis on the respect of national rights. The third narrative also is linked, we would say, to the unique case that often Greece is also presented within the EU family. It's very interesting that back even in the 90s, and this is still valid today in some aspects, some analysts like Kazakos and Ioakimidis, who have worked a lot on the Europeanization of Greece, have actually claimed that there is no doubt that Greece actually stands as a unique case among the member states of the European Union. And they list some reasons for this, such as the fact that Greece is a peripheral country, is situated in a turbulent region, is under an external threat, which is Turkey. It has a different historical and political development pattern. It's a Christian Orthodox religion and culture. Well, it's these exactly reasons that have been used to explain why Greece differs from the rest of the EU members, that they have also been used to explain why Greece has an affinity with Russia. All in all, we can say that these narratives make a positive identification of Greece with Russia as compared to a negative with the West. So there is this link. Nevertheless, none of these narratives have actually been translated into policy. Because because Greece, and this is the paradox, despite all this discussion about the exceptional case and the unique case, etc., has steadily remained within the EU and the Euro-Atlantic context. So policy-wise, and as an outcome, this special relationship cannot be seen practically. Or now, Greece, even today, and despite the crisis period, does remain within somehow the normality in the EU. And I think that the migration crisis and the way that the Greek both society and state has treated the migration crisis indicates that there is a very strong normative and value-based integration of Greece with the West, and it's part of the normality and not of the anomaly, not an anomaly in the EU. We have here just to say that Huntington, for example, predicted back in the 90s that Greece, exactly because of its religion and its Orthodox religion, did not actually belong to the West. And it was such an anomaly in the EU, and therefore it would actually form an alliance with Russia in the post-Cold War era, something which has not actually proven to be a truth as till now. There is, however, a very interesting dimension that links this relationship to the domestic appeal of this notion. The concept of this special relationship has become a subject of a process of, let's say, reification. That the assumption, therefore, that it somehow has an existence before and beyond any strategic choices, even of the Russian political elites. And this reification has actually been deliberately fostered by the elites in Greece, who see its appeal in the electorate and the possible gains they can have, either in terms of being re-elected, everybody in a government wants to be re-elected, or because it gives them a room to maneuver and shape different policies as bridges between the EU, Russia, and further on. Opinion polls actually support this. All opinion polls conducted indicate a high percentage of acceptance of Russian policies among the Greeks. In September 3% of Greeks had a favorable view of Russia, and that was actually the highest among the countries in the EU. Similar percentages were given also in a similar poll in 10 minutes, I have to guess. Yeah. Now,
do Russians run?
Yeah. So the opinion polls support this kind of domestic appeal. Now let's go to the second part in 10 minutes. We claim actually that the interests, the policies, and the norms of Greek policy, foreign policy, have been primarily shaped by its European integration. And this EU does constitute a structural and cognitive transformative power that sets the European context within which Greek-Russian special relationship evolves. I will briefly say that EU membership has been rebalancing any power asymmetries between Greece and Russia. Actually, it has been boosting the relative power that Greece has, not the absolute, of course, the relative power that Greece has over Russia. And this is something that Greece has actually used in its interaction with Russia. I will come to this slide, which explains how actually Greece has been instrumentalizing the European Union. So, as a small state, Greece has been using its membership, as we said before, to elevate its relative influence, and not in the absolute terms, of course, and has actually been using this elevating relative power to act as a bridge between Russia and the European Union. And we've seen this since the beginning, let's say, where Greece attempted to move on, to create, to collaborate with Russia by even setting a bilateral committee back in 2003 on actually working on the four common spaces. The problem, however, this is within the EU, and outside the EU, Greece has also been using its EU membership in order actually to work with Russia in an institutionalized manner in the Eastern European neighborhood, either through creating the Black Sea Synergy, which was actually a policy which is not very well known, but it was actually the outcome of a hard diplomatic work that actually Greece did back in between 2004 and 2007, when this policy was actually adopted by the European Union during the German presidency of the Council of the European Union. So these are two instances where actually the EU was instrumentalized. And there we can see an upload, let's say, process, you know, this uploading process of interest. Greece didn't have any bilateral problems with Russia to upload, like other countries in Eastern Europe. One of them, which could be actually visa, the visa liberalization issue, there as well, Greece aside with policies implemented by France, who was also pro-visa liberalization country. But there were no other bilateral issues to be uploaded. We also have to say that there was no uploading during the Greek chairmanships in the Council, because the first one that happened in 2003 focused mainly on the big enlargement with the 10 candidates countries in the EU, and also Greece then focused on Western Balkans and the enlargement also process there. And in 2014, in the next chairmanship, where Greece had an opportunity to maybe upload any Russian-related interest, then we had the crisis in Greece, and all the agenda of the chairmanship would focus on economic governance issues. One thing as well is that even this bridge, EU-Russia bridge role, actually was built not on an interests narrative on the Greek side, but also on an identity narrative. George Papandreou, at the meeting with his Russian foreign minister, Igor Ivanov, said that Greece is the sole Eastern Orthodox country in the EU and NATO, and therefore is a bridge between Orthodox and North Orthodox Europe. So we see again this narrative, identity narrative, coming back. We have to remember also that the Partnership and Cooperation Agreement in 1994 was signed during the Greek presidency of the European Union. And this bridge issue has been a recurrent topic between Greece and Russia. Now, has there been any downloading of EU in Greece? And I think that this is a case with energy. In the sector of energy and in energy policy, Greece has not actually managed to upload any interests in the EU. It has actually downloaded EU policies, EU norms, and EU, let's say, even sometimes priorities, without, of course, you know, stepping back from its own interests. Why we say this? We say this because in terms of the geopolitics, and there are two, we have also to stress here that energy has been actually the most significant aspect that has fueled these special links, and that actually even triggered Karamanlis to come closer to Russians in 2004. Now, energy is not important only for Russia, which is, but also for Greece. And there are two specific dimensions where the EU has a vital role to play. The first one is the geopolitics of the energy pipelines, and the second one, which is equally, I think, important, is with regard to business and the ability of Russian capital to invest in Greece. Briefly, because I think we ran out of time, I would say that despite the great plans for a Burgas-Alexandroupolis oil pipeline, despite South Stream pipelines, what practically Greece has actually done is that it has done a U-turn, let's say, in 2013, supporting the TAP pipeline, which is the Brussels-supported route, and has shown a great degree of consideration with regard to EU's security, energy security concerns, that they are linked to a diversification of suppliers. While in Greece, energy security means diversification of supply routes, and here we have to say probably away from Turkey again, because it seems that all, you know, the pipelines come from Turkey. So here there has been a diverse interest and definition of what energy security means. Nevertheless, we have to say that practically, Greece has actually been implementing Brussels, let's say, sponsored pipelines. Even with Burgas-Alexandroupolis, that there was a whole debate, that there was a lot of reaction from the West for this. All the people who were actually involved in the negotiations claimed that there was no pressure, there was no negative perception of Burgas-Alexandroupolis from the West, but there was for the South Stream. So the problem was the South Stream and not the Burgas-Alexandroupolis. In terms of investments, Russia has actually not been able to invest in the public a gas corporation, EDEPA, in Greece due to fears linked to the European competition law and the acquis communautaire. On the contrary, and also, which is very important, due to the new regulations with regard to the privatization process in Greece and the role of the new fund that was created and the TAIPED, etc., and the right it has to actually approve any part of privatization in Greece with this energy infrastructure and the companies. Also, there is no preferential treatment with regard to Greece when it has to do with the energy prices. And Greece is among the countries that actually pays more than others, and approximately, I think 20%, maybe I'm mistaken, because there was a reduction in the price that Greece pays compared to the rest of the West European ones. No preferential here treatment. So energy is a sector where both countries, both partners looked, acted upon their own interests, and actually Greece did consider heavily and abide with the European priorities. A turning point, I have to
maybe just skip to your conclusions and the other bits we can come back to in the discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah?
I should skip.
Just go to your conclusions, okay. I think, because it's...
Yes. Yeah, right. It's 40 minutes. Now, the conclusions is that are the following, that any special relationship requires a minimum, which is that there has to be a fundamental, there has to be an agreement between the two partners on the what we call first-order existential concerns. As long as both partners, both sides, had common views on regarding international law and how stability and the basic principles for European security should remain, like we saw that during the 90s, both Russia and Greece would actually agree upon the need to preserve principles like sovereignty, territorial integrity, and so on. That's how we saw these two partners, two sides actually agreeing on issues like the Balkans. As long as this fundamental basis of agreement on first-order security and existential, I can say, concerns existed, the partnership could actually have a meaning. But once there was no agreement, there was this fundamental basis changed, then this relationship started cracking. And this relationship started cracking when Greece, as a small country, continued its principled policy supporting sovereignty, territorial integrity, and not interference in domestic politics. But Russia, especially after 2008, became a revisionist power, not being able to be accommodated even through a Corfu process that was launched by Greece in 2009, but actually collapsed later on. So was not seen anymore by Greece as a stabilizer as it was done in the previous year. And the second, I think, problem was that damaged this relationship was actually the strategic alliance between Russia and Turkey that has taken place. And it's not only about energy, but we see that it has a wider global agenda. At the end, I'd like to say that, and this is something that was actually stated, even included in Kutsias' last statement, when we had the deterioration of relations between Russia and Greece, when he said that Russia presently appears to be unable to understand Greek foreign policy's principled positions, since it began fighting as a comrade in arms with Turkey. And it goes on. As a conclusion, first, We would agree with Christou, who also discussed Greek-Russian relations, that this is a pragmatic rather than a special relationship, Greece and Russia, that has been evolving. Second, that Greece actually has followed the general trends of European Union foreign policy, following an accommodating policy for Russian security, economy and energy cooperation without, however, compromising its own national security interests. And third, that the European Union has actually, and this is something we didn't have time to indicate because of the time, but we can discuss on this a lot, that the European Union has actually limited the impact of leadership in shaping Greece's Russia policy, and it has also impacted on the substance and the content of this bilateral relationship. As Kouloubis has said, who is a professor of IR, as he had said, and I think this is still valid today in this context, EU has been both a diplomatic lever and a restraining mechanism in terms of Greece's Russia policy. A restraining mechanism in a positive, I would say, manner. There are a couple of things that were left, and that was what Greece actually did in the case of Georgia and Ukraine. These are crucial moments that actually cracked this relationship, and how actually it behaved in these two cases, and actually in frozen conflicts in general, which is also a key topic, a key issue in EU-Russia affairs. But I think if we talk about this, we will need another day. And of course, Fyrom and the last incidents. But I hope that there will be some questions on your side.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry for rushing you along, but I thought it's important to come to an end so we can have a discussion about lots of things that you hinted at your paper, but maybe didn't have a chance to explore in great depth. We'll come back to those. Let me open up straight away and ask people if they have questions and comments. Could you please identify yourself? Thank you.
So I'm Vania Sthiyandavorg at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. So I have a couple of questions, if I may. The first one was, how did you derive the conclusion that the military comes from Russia as a counterbalance against Turkey? Like, the latest white paper has no reference of Russia, and it's my impression that we do not see them as a security guarantee against any of our threats. We are more Western oriented, and NATO comes first, and I'm not sure where Russia fits in there. And the second one had to do with continuity. You said that we had eight governments, and despite the fact that there is Russian continuity, it cannot be identified in Greece. And I was just wondering, like, even Syriza, which is a left-wing government, it hasn't been radically, you know, diverted away from previous governments. So if you could elaborate more about the continuity and the Greek foreign policy. And then my last question, if I may, is, what does Greece gain from this relationship? Like you mentioned, no preferential prices when it comes to energy. I think 3 days ago, the Russian embassy in the former Yugoslavic Republic of Macedonia said that we're not going to recognize you as Northern Macedonia. You are the Republic of Macedonia, which is something which is very important for Greek foreign policy. So where do we align? What do we gain out of this relationship? Because at the moment, we're being called out by our European partners for being an exceptional case and the last country to expel Russian diplomats.
Okay. Panetta, why don't you take that one? There's a lot in there. And come back and take some more questions after.
Thank you. All of them are very interesting. Now, counterbalancing Turkey. As I said, there is a part of myth in this, but there is also a part of reality. Let's stick to the reality aspect. the primary concern, the primary, let's say, interest for Greece is that Russia can actually be contacted, let's say, whenever there is a problem with UN resolutions, etc., at the Security Council. There has been some military cooperation as well between Russia and Greece that has taken place since the 90s. And there is and there is also, let's say, then the perception on the Greek side that Russia can actually stop the expansion of Turkey in the neighborhood. Either this is the Balkan one or the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. Especially, I would say, with the Balkans. That's the interest, that the Russian economic influence, that the Russian political influence could actually stop the Turkish, the expansion of the Turkish influence in a region which is of key security importance for Greece, I would say. These are the, I think, realities upon which this counterbalancing Russia-Turkey narrative is built. Though, as I said, there is a myth as well behind the narrative as well, that Russia has been here to support, for example, Cyprus, the Cyprus issue. We've seen, however, lately, that there are a lot of analysts who actually write about this, and actually they indicate how actually Russia has not been in support either of Cyprus or with regard to the Cyprus issue or with the bilateral Greek-Turkish issues, even with the casus belli claims of Turkey that if Russia wouldn't actually, maybe Russia is even behind this. All in all, there is a myth, but I would actually stress these issues. First, Cyprus, no matter what, Russia is a permanent Security Council a member. There are channels of communication. It can actually, and it has actually in the past, restrain Turkey's expansion in the region. And there has been some military also cooperation between Greece and Russia that we see nowadays that there is a whole discussion also on Turkey's defense cooperation with Russia as well that has created problems for Greece. Now, what does Greece gain out of the cooperation?
What about the question of continuity as well?
The continuity. I think that from the Russian side, we analysts that they follow the evolution of Russian foreign policy, I don't think they are surprised. They are not surprised by the way that Russia has been actually trying to serve its own geopolitical interests or for example, use energy as the basic instrument that's in its foreign policy. Now, on behalf of the on the side of the Greek now on the side of the Greeks now, there is, as you said, at the end, despite the changes in Greece, there is at the end a sense of continuity in our policy, either with regard to our NATO membership and how we can serve NATO, or even with Russia. However, in July 2018, we saw a break, a massive crack, let's say, on this bilateral relationship. This is a new, I would say, element in terms of the Greek foreign policy. We've never seen this before in the post-Cold War period because, okay, there was a diplomatic breakdown between Greece and the Soviet Union when the back in the 20s, but that was under another historical context. So there is continuity in terms of Greek foreign policy, but there has been a dramatic shift with regard to Russia in 2018. Now, you said that despite, I didn't get the question about despite the changes, you mean, in, despite the rhetoric in a Syriza and an L government that
no,
we
no.
still...
It was, if you could elaborate about the continuity. Like, in my view, there's no real diversion from the previous governments that we followed suit.
With regard to the EU, sorry I'm interrupting you, with regard to the EU, with regard
to
NATO, there is no...
To our bilateral relations.
Bilateral...
So that we preferred, we went to the Russians for a loan instead. To our European partners, when the
it seems that we went
tangible results.
There was
like,
yes.
So there was no, there's no tangible result like evidence to prove that you know something more than the rhetoric. Because I agree, there's a lot of meat, there is a lot of narrative, but at the end of the day, there is no actual
substance.
Like when we talked about airstrikes in Syria, we said yeah, you can use our airspace, and then hours later. Our airspace. And it's, I think we are trapped between the myth and what the people might want to hear, but at a political level, we are dedicated to the West, and this has not changed.
This has not changed.
The
yeah.
governments that
that's, yes,
that's
something. No, that's something that the paper also fully agrees with that. And that's actually something that has been seen several times in terms of the. Greek foreign policy with regard to Russia. Nevertheless, there is a change, I think, in 2008.
What
I don't know if this, I don't know if this is going to remain or not. We have to see this. But even you know the decision by Greece to expel diplomats, it's something new, and we have to wait and see because there is a visit of Tsipras next month, or not exactly next month in December in Moscow. So maybe there will be some, you know, other developments there. Now, what does Greek actually gain out of this? As you said, with Fyrom was very interesting, because Russia was the first big power, let's say, who recognized Fyrom with its constitutional name in 1992. And nobody complained in Greece. When the US did this 10 years later and more, there was a whole anti-American, protest, and that you know nobody stands by Greece. It's a very, very interesting, and I think again we have to go back, you know, to the narrative things and how you know the population perceives Russia's role. Greece, in terms of what we've seen in the. In the policy as it has been applied, I think Greece expected gains, specifically in the energy sector, and Greece really saw its place being, marginalized in the post-Cold War era, in geopolitical terms, marginalized both. Marginalized both, with regard to Turkey's enhanced role, but also marginalized in terms of its importance for its Western allies. Therefore, I think that Greece, not I think, but according to, the policies that were actually implemented, that Greece saw an opportunity using the energy tool to elevate its geopolitical importance, both for the Europeans, both for the Russians, as well as in Southeast Europe, and to actually escape this, way that it was portrayed as a problem in the Balkans, as, part of the problem, but it would seem as, a force of development, cooperation, and a positive, let's say, force. And I think the big disappointment for Greece was actually that it didn't manage to do this, because Russia chose another strategic partner, and that was Turkey for energy. And none of the big plans and energy plans were actually successful. So I think that was what was Greece specifically was expecting. Okay, the security issues that we talked about with Cyprus are permanent there, but the new thing I think was that. And that was also, as I said, the big disappointment for Greece.
Okay, thank you very much. Πάντα.
Stop me, Will, because I talk a lot.
You answer the questions, that's fine.
I have two questions, if I may.
Panda, just identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Panda Chansidis. I'm a previous student at the LSE. So one question, constructivist stress the importance of culture and religion, as you noted. I was wondering whether your thoughts about the impact of relations on breaking of relations between Moscow and the ecumenical patriarchate will have an impact on Greco-Russian relations. Does this destabilize the relationship and fragment the narrative that we have? And also, Turkey plays a role in doing this. My second question is about how much of an impact on Greco-Russian relations have elites such as the infamous Savvidis played in the common interests in the foreign relations in the foreign relations sector? If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Now about the recent the new Ukrainian problem that has emerged. This is also it also indicates how, for example, oversimplistic explanation of the relationship that is based on religion, you know, are not valid. Like Huntington thought that, you know, being an Orthodox is just one thing. I think this actually indicates how, you know, religion is not actually the main, let's say, the strongest element of this relationship, because it includes politics and power politics, and that being an Orthodox doesn't mean that, you know, the Moscow Patriarch will actually collaborate closely with the Patriarch. Now, this power, let's say, this conflict between the two Patriarchs, I don't think that it will have an impact on Greek-Russian relations as such. To start with, it's very interesting, if I'm not mistaken, because I don't follow the religion discussion that much, but if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I am, the Greek Church has not actually made any statement on this. I think that this dispute is obviously used by Moscow. We've seen statements by the political elite. I don't think that Turkey has any role to play in this conflict at all. And we have to remember also that this conflict goes back. It's not a new one. Again, with Ukraine, there was the same issue of giving an autocephaly, how you call it in English, with the Ukraine a decade ago. There was an issue with the Estonian, I think, church as well, a similar one. So it goes back. And it's I think, power politics. But I don't think that it has an impact on Greek-Russian relations, and it didn't have also in the past. It could have an impact on the relations between the Greek Church and the Patriarch, but not on Greek-Russian relations. Now, elites, yes, they do play a role, especially when we talk about small countries and the foreign policy of small countries. I think they do play a role, elites. Nevertheless, I think this is where the EU is important, because it has actually restrained them. Especially has been obvious in the last 3 years how the EU framework, either, you know, not just because they are our lenders, but as an institutional framework as well, it has actually restrained the elites. So yes, they do play a role. We've seen, for example, Bourgas Alexandroupolis wouldn't have given up so easily if it was not Papandreou at the time. Okay, at the end we would have. It seems like Bulgarians also had these concerns with environmental issues, etc. Karamanlis played a very important role, and we've seen this in Greek foreign policy, that elites do play a role, if you mean the leadership.
Actually meant something very specific about the gentleman called Ivan Savvidis,
who
appeared out of nowhere.
this is a point, actually, it's very good that you raised this issue, because this is something I didn't have time to say. And I will link it to Savvidis. What is, I think, new is that though Russia was a foreign policy issue for Greece, in the last years, it has become domestically driven. Either because of the power of Russian oligarchs that they are in Greece, like Savvidis, or because of the impact, you know, of the domestic appeal of Russia in the Greek electorate. So it has become increasingly a domestic issue. And this is something new. It was not like this before. It was a foreign policy issue. Now, I do think the domestic aspect, where Savvidis belongs, does play a role in influencing the political elite in Greece, especially the political elite that is elected in northern Greece. Does this mean that this influence is strong enough to derail the Greek foreign policy from its steady, you know, pro-Western track? No, I don't think.
Good. I'm a non-power fan. throughout the presentation, you, or the way I understood it, you seem to be focusing on Greece as a kind of powerful actor who could decide, you know, follow through decisions. So it was Greece decided to drop the Bulgarian Alexandropolis and, you know, to stop supporting the South Stream, they kind of download policy on the energy field. You know, they kind of decided to go for maybe for the bailout agreement, the third bailout agreement, rather than ask more intensively for money from Russia. And so that's all about, you know, a kind of choice that they said. And I want to ask you whether it's also an issue of ability or capability to influence things. So, for example, Greece failed to put forward, you know, to become that kind of sponsor of the EU sponsor of the South Stream, and then it was only up to, you know, ailing Balkan states or Russia to push for it. So then, obviously, and, you know, this thing goes through. You know, the Bulgarian took for so many years,
nice.
And it was then economically unsustainable, environmentally unsustainable, so it had to be dropped. But then Greece didn't also have a very positive successful role in pushing for it. I think similarly, if you think about the Ukrainian crisis, any other kind of frictions between the West and Russia, that Greece didn't actually manage to play this kind of very instrumental role on, if you want, translating Russian views and interests into the vocabulary of, if you want, the European Union. So the Western orientation that comes then as the outcome of this is not necessarily a choice, or at least a free choice, but it's also, you know, a choice subject to a constraint, which is I'm not able to put any substance into this special relationship. So that's my question slash kind of view. So I'd like to comment on that, whether it's an ability, capability issue rather than a strategic orientation issue.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. I followed, let's say, a very, as I said at the beginning, Athenian centered, you know, approach, presenting it, as before I said, a little bit as a, you know, powerful actor that actually sets its goals and goes for them. I would somehow agree with you that, yes, it's also an issue of failures. But it's not that, you know, Greece actually couldn't actually move on with its energy plans because EU imposed its own policies, because Bulgaria made another choice, or because Greece made another choice. It's also an issue of capabilities, and I think this is this is actually proven with the discussions, for example, for the Northern Stream, and Nord 2. there you see the power capacity and the capabilities of Germany just, you know, shaped the whole EU energy map. Greece couldn't do this. Greece with Bulgaria, let's say, couldn't do this. So it's true that, of course, the capabilities and the relative power of Greece in the EU did play a role. And I would say this was even more obvious in EU's Eastern policy. Greece was not happy with the Eastern Partnership. Not happy, but was not... The concept of the Eastern Partnership was not in accordance with the priorities and the way that, you know, Greece wanted to see the EU Eastern policy evolving. And as long as Greece worked closely with Germany to develop for the first time an EU policy towards the East, and that was the Black Sea Synergy in February 2007, things worked well. Once Greece didn't have you know, the support of another big power, then it couldn't actually upload its own policy preferences. Once, let's say, to remain in the EU's Eastern policy, once Germany actually lost an interest in the synergy due to other reasons, you know, 2007, the crisis was coming from, and actually 2008 was actually started being implemented. In 2007, it was just a ceremony. We have the crisis coming, we have issues with regard to the EU institutional changes, etc. Then Russia gave up, and Greece couldn't actually do anything on its own for EU's Eastern policy. And that's when we had the Eastern Partnership coming up in 2009 as an initiative of Poland, which was something totally different. There, I think there is clearly a failure also of Greece, to an inability actually to upload any of its policy. I don't know if I replied at all. And about Ukraine, you said as well a little bit. Greece, when the Ukrainian issue erupted, Greece actually had the presidency of the Council of the European Union in the first half of 2014. And actually, for Greece, Ukraine was an issue that, you know, they didn't want to deal with, actually, because it was in the middle of the crisis. Greece had existential economic problem back then. Great degree of uncertainty in the political life. The problem, therefore, Greece actually didn't want to deal with that.
I was thinking in particular on the deep and comprehensive
free trade agreement.
Because Greece could have anticipated that Russia would not like that.
Greece anticipated, yeah.
But we didn't, did Greece try to, okay, we don't want to try to block it openly, but did Greece try to...
To somehow influence.
Yeah. Because I thought they didn't, but I don't.
For the deep and comprehensive, yes.
Yeah.
Greece at the beginning, let's say, what Greece wanted to do in terms of policy, it wanted actually somehow to take this the concept of four common spaces, let's say, and implement it also in the East, where Russia and the EU would actually had a horizontal relationship. And in that relationship, the other countries in the region, like Ukraine, like Georgia, etc., would actually join. That was the concept, that was the format, that was the synergy. That's why when the partnership with the deep comprehensive, etc., and also the window of opportunity for enlargement that was irritating Russia, appeared there, that's why Greece at that time was not at all supportive of the Eastern Partnership. And it was not only Greece. I have to tell you that even the staff at the European Commission was actually annoyed with this, let's say, Polish proposal, because they had just been working for like 4 years for the synergy, preparing, you know, everything, and you have to a little bit think how bureaucrats also think. And then, you know, Poland comes with this nice proposal that it is actually being accepted. Greece actually couldn't stop it. There was no way to stop it. Still, if you see the European Parliament, the Syriza members have voted against the association agreement for Ukraine, for Georgia, for Moldova. They have voted, I think, only in favor of, in the case of Moldova, for the deep and comprehensive free trade agreement. The other members, however, from the other political parties, they have voted in favor. So that's where you can see somehow Greece actually taking a different approach. Greece was not happy, I think, with the policy, but couldn't actually stop it. That's, yeah. And though they were not also, and in 2017, also Greece changed a lot the rhetoric about Ukraine. Until then, they were against the sanctions, not against, but let's say even Tsipras, you know, had been in 2015 in Moscow, and he said that the sanctions create problems, that they can actually generate a new Cold War, etc. But when he went to Kiev in 2017, the whole, you know, arguments of on Tsipras had changed. That, you know, sanctions, unfortunately, though they hurt the Greek economy, he said Greece would never actually create a problem in EU common policy for Ukraine.
Okay, could I just abuse my position here for a second and make a few comments? No, not to stop you, just to make a few comments, because there's some things here which I find very, very interesting, and there's some parallels which perhaps you may want to explore if you continue with this particular research. If I could just make two very brief comments on this idea of a special relationship. From my point of view, and like you, I come from the world of international relations, a special relationship tends to start from the premise that there is some kind of common worldview, that you share certain principles and beliefs about a particular international system or how you want to change it or maintain it or act within it. The most common example of a special relationship is between the US and the UK. In discussion before, you talked about a special relationship perhaps between Britain and France. And there may be other, but not very many examples that you can use of a special relationship. All of those, or two at least that we mentioned, have got some kind of greater vision about the international system of the world. I don't see that evident in any any possible manifestation in terms of Greece and Russia. So that's one point. Stemming from that is that in your presentation, I think you rightfully pointed out to the fact that reciprocity and solidarity are two key ingredients of any kind of special relationship. And I find very little continuity in terms of reciprocity and solidarity, or very little evidence of reciprocity and solidarity, which links in very clearly, I think, to especially Russian foreign policy, post-Soviet foreign policy, being highly opportunistic. There's nothing there to do with solidarity and reciprocity. It's to do with opportunity. It's to do with finding the particular vulnerable point at a particular time to carry out a poke in the eye of the Western world, the European Union, the United States of America, whatever it might be. So that's also an indication that this special relationship may not be that special. Mm-hmm. The third point I'd like to make is this reference you made to the transition of Russia in Greece's terms from a foreign policy issue to a domestic policy issue in the recent past. I think I agree that at times it's a foreign policy issue and at times it's a domestic issue, but I don't think this is a new phenomenon. In the 1970s, in the second half of the 1970s, Konstantinos Karamanlis made an opening towards the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. That was a foreign policy issue. It was a foreign policy issue with regional implications. It was a foreign policy issue with respect to a balancing act and finding not new allies, but new ways of manifesting Greece's insecurity and need to have friends. But in the 1980s, you know, under the first PASOK government especially, you had the use of Russia for domestic purposes completely. It may have been done in a foreign context, it may have been done in the context of the European community, but it was a domestic issue. It fell into the nice rhetorical trap of saying we don't want the bases here and then the bases stay, and we don't want to have reliance on the Western world.
Do you talk about Kamenos and?
We'll come to him. We'll come to him in a second.
Because you talk about NATO, not here.
No, we'll come. We'll come to him in a second. But the point is that even Syriza itself has had this use of Russia as a domestic, mm-hmm. as a domestic policy referent. It's nothing to do really with foreign policy. So it's not just the transition from foreign policy to domestic policy. I think it's a flip-flopping. It's a sort of, mm-hmm. again, opportunistic. There's nothing continuous about it. There's no solidarity or reciprocity there. And the last point is to do with narratives over reality. And here, there is a really, I think, strong contemporary parallel between Greece and Russia and the case of Serbia and Russia, which I think if you were to continue this work, you may want to look into as something you could use, because there as well, you have a very strong narrative, and the narrative is based on exactly some of the same conditions that you mentioned, the church, history, region. They understand us better than others, but when it comes to it, there's nothing really reciprocal or long-term in terms of solidarity there. It's very opportunistic. So I'll just... some comments there which may or may not help you with your research if you continue down this line. If you don't want to comment on that... I'm sorry?
How far is Crimea from Greece?
Yeah.
What's the point of the question?
Well,
I'm sorry?
Because the Russians went into Crimea, took over Crimea. It's a very strategic place.
Mm-hmm. You mean in terms of as a threat, let's say, you know, that's it's close to us. That's what you mean. Yeah. It is close to us in terms of the breach of international law. It's not a matter of geography, but what happened in Crimea is extremely important for Greece due to the fact that, you know, you have. Sovereignty being actually not respected, and this is a core, this is a central point of Greek foreign policy. So, it does have play. It's very important for the Greek foreign policy. Though in the past we've seen a lot of references to a double, let's say, role that Greece was playing, supporting Russia in Crimea, etc. This actually has never been a Greek policy, official policy. There have been, you know, cases where people affiliated with the far rightist political side or with the Golden Dawn, etc., supporting certain activities in eastern Ukraine or with the Crimea, but that was never Greek foreign policy, official Greek foreign policy. Now, what Spiros said, it's a good way to summarize my paper. common world views, whether Greece and Russia has a common world views. Share a common worldview. This actually happened in the 90s, I would say, somehow. That both sides, for different reasons, they wanted to maintain the European security order as it was. There was not a totally harmony of views, but I think there was a common, let's say, approach. And not only between Greece and Russia, but also between the West and Russia. But this dominant liberal institutionalism policy, you know, practice was actually a policy option was actually approved. Let's say had the was applied both by the West and Russia. So at that point, moment of history, I think there was a minimum of common world view, not just between Greece and Russia, as I said, but between West and Russia. But we don't see this anymore. There is nothing of that anymore. That's why the relationship, I think, has no anything special in it. I agree with you in terms of the solidarity and the reciprocity. I would say it's more like built on specific narratives, that they could influence policy, but they haven't till now. There isn't actually a lot of solidarity seen practically in any of the first security concerns of Greece. And this is, I think, something that maybe due to the crisis we somehow realize anymore. Yes, you said that it was a domestic issue in the past and it's still today. You know, Russia had a domestic issue as well, but because exactly it had an appeal to the Greek electorate. That's why Papandreou could use it, Tsipras could use it, and especially in the cases when you had a lot of like populist elites taking power in Greece. I think the difference today is that you also see some kind of specific business interests and political, and which actually try to influence the political elite. So it's not that the political elite takes Russia, uses Russia in its, because of its appeal to the electorate, but there is another channel where you have Russian business interests and also maybe political leaders, that they try to influence the Greek political elite. I think this is relatively new, and it's relatively new also because, you know, during the previous decades, Russia didn't have this ability to be present in the domestic business and in domestic political life of Greece, either by, you know, trying to create a political party or investing in real estate, you know, or buying a newspaper. That was not here before. Now, you know, Russia does have this ability. So I think this is the new part. But I fully agree that it was a domestic issue in other terms. Narratives, yes. I think this relationship is full of narratives. It's built on narratives.
Okay. We have run out of time now. I'd like to just make one small announcement before we thank Panayota, and that's that our next seminar in this series is actually next week on Tuesday the 30th of October, same time, same place. The speaker is Professor Nikos Christodoulakis, Professor of Economics at the Athens University of Economics. And the title of the seminar is Rebooting the Greek Economy, How Greece Can Lift Growth, Employment and Stabilize Public Debt. In the meantime, please join me in thanking Panayota for her presentation this evening. Thank you.
Thank you for staying with us. And thank you for your comments.